Blog Talk Radio. Everybody, and welcome to episode 38 of Trundlebed Tales, Thanksgiving History. And we're going to join our very special guest, Sandy Oliver, in just a minute. But first, we have just a little housekeeping. And I just want to first off remind you that if you want to call in and ask a question, or if you just find it easier to listen by phone, you can call in either at 714-242-5253. That's 714-242-5253. Or toll free 1-877-633-9389. That was 1-877-633-9389. And I want to recommend, if you like tonight's episode, you may also want to go back and listen to last year's Thanksgiving, which was kind of an interesting thing, too. And in just about a week, Wednesday, November 21st, the day before Thanksgiving, so if you are on the way to Grandmother's house, you can dial it and listen to this by the phone. But I'm going to be talking to Linda and Jack Hutton about Ella Montgomery and the Bala Museum. So I think that'll be another episode that you'll want to check out. And it, again, will be at an earlier time than normal. So you can look for that 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 7 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Mountain Time, and 5 p.m. Pacific. And I just got the November update recorded last night, so if you missed that, you want to make sure that you take a listen to that and find out all the interesting Laura things that are going on this month, and be especially sure to look at your local playhouses, because it seems to be the new tradition to have a Laura Ingalls Wilder show at Christmas a lot of places. So see if there's one coming up near you. And I think that's about it for our housekeeping. And that gets us back to our guest. Now, we're going to be talking today to Sandy Oliver, who is the author of Giving Thanks, a book about the history of Thanksgiving. But if you are interested in historic foodways at all, you will have heard of her name before and her marvelous food history news. It was a wonderful newsletter, sadly no longer in production, but if you can find copies, I am sure that you will just learn a lot. I always did. And if some of you wondered why my blog is called Sarah's Notebook, it's because the blog that I liked to read the best was Sandy's, and she called it the Editor's Notebook. So that's where I got the name. And with that, I'm going to bring Sandy back up. Hi, welcome to the
show. I'm so flattered, Sarah. Nice. Lovely to be with you.
Well, I'm just so glad that you could come. And I know I said all this before when I called, but really, I really am just so happy that you could do this. I think it's going to be a great episode, and I think everybody will enjoy it.
I do, too.
Okay, do you want to start out telling us a little bit more about yourself?
Oh, sure. I've been doing food history since 1971, a very long time. When I first was working at Mystic Seaport Museum, I developed a fireplace cooking program. Never guessed that food history would grab me the way it did. And, you know, in 1971, nobody was doing food history, really, to speak of. There were a few little projects here and there. And, of course, museums had fireplace cooking programs. I remember at the time we all deplored how much gingerbread was made, and and very little else. I was intent on making sure that our program at Mystic Seaport had lots of other things going on besides gingerbread. I never expected that food history would grab me quite the way it did, and I remember one of the first things. Once the program had been in place for a year, I did a whole Thanksgiving dinner on the hearth. It was so much fun. I adored doing it. It was just so much fun cooking doing the pies a couple of days in advance and making mincemeat and doing all that kind of stuff in the day of, roasting a turkey and making sure there were all the usual accompaniments in the way of potatoes and squash and all that. And then at the end of the day, staff members and orphans from around sat down and we all ate the Thanksgiving dinner. So Thanksgiving and hearth cooking are sort of inextricably linked for me. The tradition of the holiday is very important to me.
Well, it really is the holiday, I think, that's most associated with food. Now, you kind of talked about your program and when you did the hearth cooking, but for the listeners out there who may not really be familiar with it, what exactly do you mean by food history?
Everything to do with history, everything to do with food in the past. There are people who call themselves culinary historians, and I always think of them as the sort of the genealogists of history, the genealogists of food, people who look very closely at recipes and the evolution of particular recipes. I love doing that work too, but for me, the word food history is a wider umbrella, if you will. It takes in absolutely everything you can possibly imagine with food, not just the cooking of it, but the serving, all of the habits associated with it, people's attitudes towards it, how it evolves over time, production, all the economic issues around food, all of the holiday celebrations with food, how different groups of people ate, not just ethnic groups, but different social groups ate. Trade routes, food storage and preservation, food technology, agriculture, industrialized food, everything that has to do with history has to do with food, and its history comes under the title of food history. So, you know, go ahead, knock yourself out, you know. There's a lot to do.
Yes, there is a lot of work to it. So when did you decide to go from just sort of trying to figure out your own little program to really delving into wanting to do serious research on it and saying, yes, food is a topic that's worthy of history?
About 2 years. I mean, all I wanted to do was just make sure that we had a body of recipes that I thought were appropriate to the period that we represented, which was roughly the 1830s. And I wanted to make sure we had the right equipment in the house and that I knew my way around the hearth and I knew how to build a fire and keep it going and talk to visitors at the same time. And then I trained other people in it. But, you know, the more I read about it, in order to get this information together, the more I realized that this was a very rich topic. And the other thing that happened was people would come in and tell me things that they remembered about their family's food history, too, and began to realize that there were lots of strong connections between the past and the present as far as food was concerned. So right away, the horizon opened right up. And I began to realize that there's a lot more to this than I had ever perceived at first. The other thing that's really wonderful about it, Mystic Seaport is a maritime museum. There's ships and there's boats and cooperages and a blacksmith shop and boat building and all the rest of that. Well, there's a lot of people, of course, who know about those things and like them and came to the museum to be introduced to them and all the rest of that. There are a whole lot of people for whom it was such foreign territory They come into the Buckingham household, and they look at the fireplace there, and they looked at the food, and they thought, oh, shoot, here's something I really can relate to. We all eat, and some of us do it 3, 4, or more times a day. And so, you know, food is something we all understand on some level or another. So there was an instant, I could make an instant connection with people where when I was trying to discuss boat building, there were some people whose eyes just totally glazed over, you know, the whole notion of a lapstrake versus, you know, sheer plank and all the rest of that kind of stuff was, well, I don't know anything about that. Talk about potatoes, though. You got everybody on the same page.
And let me warn listeners who have not been involved with Living History before, that is sort of a common thing. You start out and you think you're just going to do this little thing, but the more you get into it, the more important it is for accuracy, and that accuracy starts to go in different directions. So you start with cooking, and then you can't get what you want to cook, so you have to move to gardening, and you want to make sure your clothes are right, and then you have to make sure your hair is right, and you can't wear your plastic glasses anymore, and it's just sort of snowballs, and the longer you're in it and the deeper you're in it, the more things you want to get right. So it does really pull you in. I think if they want to get somebody interested in history, having them do some living history is probably the best way, because it really does sort of become an addiction that feeds on itself, because you want to do the best you can. So.
Yeah, it's fun to explore it too, to feel it.
Yeah.
Surround us. Yeah.
Okay, so why did you decide to write a book about Thanksgiving and its food ways?
Well, now here's when I have to make sure that I talk about Kathleen Curtin, who was my co-author, and about Plymouth Plantation, who have been dealing with the Thanksgiving story forever and ever and ever. Plymouth Plantation, of course, is a living history museum of the earliest English settlement in Plymouth, Massachusetts. And it is the supposed site of the what we call the first Thanksgiving. So Plymouth Plantation has been sort of pounded over the head with this Plymouth, with the first Thanksgiving story ever since its existence. And a few years ago, they put together a very comprehensive exhibit on the whole story of Thanksgiving, what really happened in 1621 and how that event evolved into the holiday that we know now, which involves, you know, everybody sitting down and watching, in New England at least, the Patriots play somebody or another, and eat turkey and all that. How did the holiday evolve? What were all the bits and pieces for it? And out of that exhibit came the book. Kathleen was in charge of the food waste program and eventually was working in visitor services. And she called me up and said, well, we have this project, but I don't know any. She knew a lot about the Pilgrim era Thanksgiving story, and she was an avid foodie. So she was picking up on all kinds of great stuff, 20th century stuff. She knew that I knew a lot about the 19th century Thanksgiving, which is really, the 19th century is really when Thanksgiving congeals and becomes the holiday that it is now. And I had also looked into quite a lot about the 18th century Thanksgiving, what happened in the 1700s. So we decided to share this whole thing and do the project together. And she called me up and gave me a contract to do part of the book. I did the 19th and 18th centuries part, and she did the 17th century and got a lot of help from Plymouth Plantation members and others to do the 20th century part. And so it was a big old collaborative effort and lots of fun. I had a heck of a fine time working with Kathleen on that book. And we got along really well. We had a similar sense of humor. And then we were blessed with this wonderful editor at Clarkson Potter who took my words and her words And I swear to you, I read through the book now, and I don't remember writing what I wrote, but because it all seems so seamless. And then Kathleen and I sort of went forth. She's now a teacher, and I am doing more freelancing than food history. But every November rolls around, and we're both back on the good old Giving Thanks page, and talking about the holiday.
Now, it's interesting because while you might have special foods for other holidays, for Thanksgiving, food was really kind of the star of the show, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. And, people tell me all the time that they really like Thanksgiving and they like it better than Christmas. So I always say, well, why? They say, it's about food. You know, presents and all the rest of that kind of stuff really creates a lot of tension in people. You know, turkey, mashed potatoes, pumpkin pie, that's easy. Getting people all together for dinner, no problem. Well, I mean, it can be a problem, obviously, in some cases, but it isn't quite so fraught with anxiety and tension that giving, having gifts and doing everything that you need to do at Christmas is. It's a lot of it's all about food. It's really, in fact, I get kind of a kick out of every November rolls around, and it's as if somebody had declared that it was National Food History Month. The Thanksgiving is so much about food, and it reminds us that our food has a past, and all of a sudden we're curious about it. Well, why do we eat mashed potatoes on Thanksgiving? And how come we don't have boiled pheasant or something else? Why turkey? All these great questions come up.
Mm-hmm. So people have an image in their heads from pop culture of that first Thanksgiving being a feast between the Native Americans and the Pilgrims that immediately started the tradition. How accurate is that image?
Not at all. Oh, this is such a difficult thing. There certainly was a feast. It was described extremely briefly. We barely have a clue what the menu was. When we look closely at the holiday, it was not nearly as we couldn't describe it unilaterally as a celebratory feast. It certainly was for the English because they were feeling a little bit relieved with their harvest. They felt that they had a solid harvest behind them, and they just wanted to do the usual English autumn thing, which was some kind of a harvest observance. And the Calvinists, with the Calvinists, becomes a Thanksgiving. There's one eyewitness account of the holiday, 1621. Whenever Kathleen and I talk about, we always say the event of 1621 because we're trying not to use the word first Thanksgiving. So the event of 1621, there was a harvest celebration. It was described by Edward Winslow in a letter he wrote to someone in England. And about all he had to say about the menu was that he said, our governor sent four men on fowling, and they four in one day killed as much fowl as, with a little help besides, served the company almost a week. Of course, there were about 50 English settlers maybe at that time. And then they were out shooting off their firearms, which alarmed the Wampanoag. They were thinking, what in heaven's name are those people doing? There were 90 of them, so the English were severely outnumbered. The Wampanoag gathered up a fairly decent force just in case something was amiss. Now, here comes the rest of the menu. So the Wampanoag come. They bring Massasoit with them. That is their great king. 90 men, with probably also women and children, so there were many more Wampanoag than just 90. And they feasted them for about 3 days, they say. And they went out and killed 5 deer. So we know there was venison and fowl, waterfowl probably, wild waterfowl. And that's all we know about the menu, for sure. So you can see that this... The English were pretty intent on celebrating. They were doing a traditional English harvest festival in the fall. They were giving thanks for having a harvest and having managed to survive thus far. They do the things, they exercise their arms, which was a kind of sport. They scare the dickens out of the neighboring Wampanoag, who gather themselves up in expecting possibly to meet some kind of action, possibly hostile. They show up. They realize it's somebody's party. They say, oh, all right, let's go get some venison to contribute to this. And everybody, you know, I feel sorry for the women who must have just spent all of their time cooking and getting ready another set of food for this crowd of people.
Especially with no warning. I mean, you know,
can you imagine somebody dropping by with 5 deer and drop here you go.
Oh yeah, that would be great.
And you ready? You want to have something to go with it. You want to have some vegetables on the side or some kind of sauce or make a gravy or do something, you know. Oh, my glory. What a time. But that was it. That was all we know about that first Thanksgiving. And at that time in history, this was not Thanksgiving with a capital T the way it is now. We say, well, what are you going to do for Thanksgiving? And we're talking about capital T Thanksgiving. There were lots and lots of Thanksgivings, so there were little T's on them. The days declared by governors and others, just to kind of drop back for a little bit, say a prayer of gratitude, to say thank you for something having gone well, the end of a drought. Success in a battle, and some reason to just to be thankful for a minute or two. Lots and lots of little tea Thanksgivings, and they're scattered all over the colonies, and often are the cause of counterclaims that actually the first Thanksgiving was held someplace else. But if one looks very closely at the event actually held elsewhere, it doesn't involve the feast. It involves a proclamation of gratitude and possibly attendance at church. But the notion of a meal shared by a family or community group is in the Big T tradition isn't very common at all except in New England for it develops and comes into prominence in the 1700s.
Okay, let's kind of move forward a little bit in history. So when was Big T Thanksgiving officially established?
Well, now that depends on, you know, here's your typical historian's response. Well, actually, usually people say, well, it wasn't even established until 1864. That's when that was when we had our first national proclamation of Thanksgiving, declared by President Lincoln at Sarah Josepha Hale's bequest. She had been on every president's case and senators and anybody else who would listen to her for 20 years up to that time. She really felt that that America, the country, ought to have a national Thanksgiving holiday. She, of course, grew up with a regional Thanksgiving holiday, which in New England had been regularly proclaimed and observed probably from the very late 1600s. I think the state of Connecticut has the record for the most consistent, regular, annual proclamation for Thanksgiving, usually late November, early December. A lot of the rest of the New England states did the same thing, and that's the governor would just say, we're setting aside X day as the annual Thanksgiving, and you know, and then he would go on to say all the things we ought to be grateful for. But in fact, it was just, you know, a day of family reunion, a day to knock off and feast together, as well as attend church for prayerful thanks as well. So we had a habit. We had a habit that was already probably close to 150 years old by the time Abraham Lincoln got around to declaring the national one. You know, wherever New Englanders went, they took the national holiday with them. So even as they settled into you know, western parts, they took the holiday with them and observed it there. So a lot of the country was observing Thanksgiving. I think probably even parts of the South had some kind of a Thanksgiving observance as well. And of course, in Canada, they did too. They do it earlier in the season. They do it in October. But, you know, your average Yankee really likes to get everything nailed down, get all the butchering done, get everything in the barn, you know, make sure everything is really okay, and then you relax. And we waited until later in the month, later in November to do it.
So tell me a bit about the different take on Thanksgiving between North and South.
Yes, well, that period of unpleasantness in the middle of the 1800s really, really spoiled Thanksgiving for the South. It was somebody referred to it as a damned Yankee holiday, and wanted nothing to do with it. And then, you know, and as the South worked its way through Reconstruction and all the feeling of resentment towards Yankees was extended towards Thanksgiving as well. I'm sure lots of families got together for some kind of a fall. Observance of gratitude, but it really took a couple of decades before the memory was eased enough that Southerners could get on board with Thanksgiving, and when they do, Thanksgiving acquires a whole, you know, additional cluster of great stuff to eat, like sweet potato things. Sweet potato pie, pecan pies, and cornbread stuffings or dressings, and all kinds of great stuff. So once they join in on it, the menu improves, it enlarges, you know, and it's a great thing.
And moving ahead a little further, and it's just because I think this joke is hilarious in the movie Holiday Inn, where the guy. The inn is only open on the holidays a year, and they always show the calendar right before they show the event. And right before Thanksgiving, they show the month of November, and then they show the day of Thanksgiving moving around, and the little turkey that's supposed to be on Thanksgiving is chasing it, trying to catch where Thanksgiving
is. Trying to figure out. I know. Well, you know, even in the 1930s, people recognized that Thanksgiving marked the beginning of the Christmas buying season. Of course, nowadays, Halloween marks the beginning of the Christmas buying season. But in the 20th century, some people asked FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, to move Thanksgiving up just a little bit to extend the Christmas buying season just a little bit. So for a couple of years, he moved it to something like the third Thursday in November, where customarily it had been the fourth Thursday in November. And a lot of people were very upset about it. Some people celebrated twice. But, you know, really what people wanted was just to settle on that good old fourth Thursday. And eventually that's what happened. But in between the time that Roosevelt tried to make the commercial part of our population happy by moving it to the third, and the time when it settles on the fourth, those early Thanksgivings were called Franksgivings. Franksgiving was held on the third Thursday. Just, you know, there was a little bit of confusion there, but it's, you know, I think it's a very telling thing, though, that early, you know, we talk now about Black Friday, which is the day after Thanksgiving. Well, people knew that the Friday after Thanksgiving was a great day to sell stuff, and that was well over, you know, nearly 100 years ago, you know.
Yeah. Okay, so that first Thanksgiving you talked about was really celebrated by the community as a whole, but it sort of became more for individual families. How long did that process take?
Hardly any time at all. Hardly any time at all. As soon as a community was reasonably well settled and people had their own homes and their own family units and all that, the communal thing was to go to church together in the morning on Thanksgiving, and so everybody would troop off to church, and then they would have their meal later on. That starts easing off by the late 1700s. There's, you know, some folks go to church, but the people in charge of cooking the meal tended to stay at home and see to the finishing touches on it. So it was a family-centric holiday. People would, it still is. This is the day when people travel all over the country to be with their family. Many more people stay home on Christmas. Thanksgiving is a day for reunion, and that was true even by the late 1700s, early 1800s. People would go quite a ways, you know, over the river and through the woods to grandmother's house to celebrate the holiday. So it was family groups, family reunion day, as well as a feast.
Okay, with some of the basics out of the way, let's turn to the important stuff, the food.
The food, right?
Are there any of the food traditions we have today that really related to what we think they had at the event of 1621?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. A lot of us think that everything we eat was part of the first Thanksgiving. But as we know, we only know about wildfowl, which certainly could include turkey, and venison. I don't know anybody... Well, there must be somebody who eats venison for Thanksgiving. If you make a traditional mincemeat in Maine, you're making it out of venison. Let's say you have venison for Thanksgiving. But sure, I mean, and the turkey, we have the turkey mostly because in the 19th century it was a very fashionable bird to eat. Now let's just take a quick squint at Christmas. You know, in the Christmas Carol, when at the very end, and Scrooge sees the error of his ways, and he calls out to the guy, the little boy in the street, and he says, "Say there, do you know that big turkey that's hanging in the poulterer's window?" And the boy says, "Yes, yes, the one that's as big as I am." And he says, "Yes, yes, young man, that's exactly right. What a smart young fellow. Here's, you know, a crown, go get that and take it to this address." Meanwhile, you know, in the story, the Cratchits are huddled around a goose. A goose was not the most prime kind of eating on Christmas Day. Goose was a pretty poor kind of bird to eat. Turkey was the thing. That's why Scrooge has a turkey sent to them. So, you know, if we have a fashionable bird like a turkey, one that people value and think is an excellent kind of bird to have on a holiday, and if you can make some kind of leap to our sainted pilgrim forebears, who probably, we think, ate turkey on the first Thanksgiving. Well, then it's a slam dunk, right? You're going to have turkey.
Yes.
So we kind of conflate these things, and that's why we have turkey.
You know, now you said that, though, one of my cousins always has some venison jerky. I'm going to make sure they bring some for Thanksgiving this year.
So very good.
Venison.
Good.
Okay, so what's the turkey that we think about, though, is way different than what they would have had from the wild turkey. So
yes.
Give us some of the differences.
Well, a wild turkey has a great deal more dark meat on it, and it's very lean. If someone is eating an heirloom turkey for Thanksgiving, they're bound to get something much, much more like what early turkeys much more similar to a wild turkey. The first time I ever cooked an heirloom turkey, I was really struck at how quickly it cooked, and in a lot of the earlier cookbooks, they'll say, "Well, roast a 10-pound turkey for X number of hours." And I used to look at that and think, "That's not enough time. It takes longer than that to cook a turkey." Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, it did not take longer than that to cook a turkey. Those early turkeys were lean. They cooked quickly. They're darker, richer. It's a darker, richer meat. The one that we have now, of course, has just tons and tons of white breast meat on it that they've been bred to be top-heavy. Really a very different turkey experience. So.
And the turkey, most people today have one particular breed, right? And I just lost the name of it out of my head, but it's been bred so they really can't even reproduce naturally because their breast is so big. And so it's kind of different. Yeah.
Why would if it's true that we are what we eat, why would you want to eat a bird like that?
I don't know. I'll tell you, the Cornish crosses chickens we used to raise, that they were supposed to be the friars, those poor things, they were so fat they could hardly stand up after a bit. It was, but anyway, the turkey, because this is always a fun story when you mention turkeys. Turkeys were in the running to be our national bird.
Yes, I know. Benjamin Franklin thought they should be. He thought they were very cunning birds. I mean, I'm not so sure about that. An awful lot of the early accounts of wild turkeys make them sound like very stupid creatures. Indeed, they line up on a branch to roost at night, and if you went out, you could just pick them off one by one by one, and the others wouldn't fly away. So I don't know why he thought they were so smart. But.
Well, and the other big part of the holiday is pardoning the turkey today, presidential. But that really hasn't been going on as long as I thought it had when I was reading about it in your book.
What a silly little exercise that is. I suppose it's fun. And, I know there's a lot of vegetarians who applaud the pardoning of the bird. What in heaven's name do you do with one live turkey for? I don't know how long they live. it's cute. It's a charming custom.
Yeah, if I ever get to Washington, D.C., I want to go visit the turkeys at the petting zoo where they have them.
Oh, is that right? I wonder how many are in there now.
I don't know. There must be quite a few.
For a natural death.
Yeah, and you wouldn't really want to pet them. I mean, they're not exactly kind creatures.
Well, no, they're not. I mean, have you ever heard of a lap turkey? I mean,
no. No, but I've never. There used to be on a road we used to drive by, this guy that just let his turkeys run. And one time we were coming along, and this was when we had, a big Chevy Caprice, this huge car, and the turkey just stood there in the center of the road and would not move for anything. That's what turkeys are. They're big, immovable birds.
Yeah, not the brainiest bird on the block, is it?
No.
Well, yeah, there you go. It's really nice to see so many more wild turkeys now. I mean, there's here in Maine, there's now a wild turkey hunting season, and there's been some effort to restore wild flocks. It's kind of nice to see them in the field.
Yes.
They really are big birds, pretty to look at.
So let's move on to another thing that's associated with Thanksgiving, cranberries. How did they become can-shaped?
By being put in cans, Sarah. Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Cranberries are a valuable crop in the middle 1800s in Cape Cod and places where they grew well. In fact, some families who harvested them really couldn't afford to eat them, which is, seems so ironic, but that's often true when you have a valuable market commodity. You can't. You need to sell everyone that you can sell. You don't eat them yourself. But they took well to canning. When canning takes off in the middle 1800s, cranberry sauce, cranberries are certainly one of the ones that adapted well to canning. I know somebody who insists on having canned cranberry sauce on the table because they really like the ridges so that you can slice your cranberry sauce precisely at the ridge and you get precise slices, all very neat, same size slices.
Well, it's interesting because you do get used to having it one way and you don't want it another way after that's what, because that's how it is. Though, although,
sure.
I must mention this, if anybody out there has not yet tried the cranberry jello, I strongly recommend it because it's awesome. We buy it out this time of year and stock up because we just love it.
There we go.
Jello.
I'm glad they're making cranberry jello. It's a good seasoning to use. Yeah, every year I make a cranberry molded salad, using almost any species of red jello. But now that they have the cranberry one, it's easy to make it with the cranberry, and it has a lot of cranberry sauce folded into it, and celery and apples and all kinds of great stuff. It's a wonderful mold, not too sweet.
So. Okay.
And it's not can shaped at all.
I know. So let's move on to sweet potatoes. Or as Ray Barone put it, without the marshmallows, it's just another vegetable.
I guess that's true. Oh, goodness. Yeah. Well, that's our contribution from the South. Good old sweet potatoes. Even Yankees like sweet potatoes on Thanksgiving, candied sweet potatoes. You know, those layers of brown sugar and butter and sweet potato, pretty yummy. And then there are those who simply have to have the marshmallows on top.
Yep.
I can't tell you how many Thanksgiving dinners I've been to where there's, you know, a pristine dish of sweet potatoes, and then there's the one that has the marshmallows on it. We certainly do. I have a feeling that was concocted by, you know, the Marshmallow Manufacturing Association.
Probably. Okay, and another thing that's often on the table is stuffing, either inside or outside of the bird.
Yes. Well, now, you know, if it's outside, it's very likely to be called dressing.
Mm-hmm.
If you put it inside, then you get to call it stuffing. Good stuff. And that's, you know, that's a long-term habit, this business of stuffing creatures that are hollow. Almost any kind of hollow creature, which is almost any kind of a bird, got some kind of stuffing crammed in it, some force meat. Either bread or meat or some other thing put inside of it. I guess nature and culinary history abhors a vacuum, so we put something in those hollows. It certainly helps, I think, add flavor, and it maintains moisture, not to mention making something that's really delicious to eat, too, the stuffing.
And Stephanie has a place of pride in the Little House book because Laura and Mary have a horrible argument when they're on Silver Lake. Pa goes out to get a duck or a goose that was flying over. And while he's gone, Laura and Mary have a horrible fight about the stuffing because one of them wants it flavored with onion and the other one wants it flavored with sage. And they go back and forth and back and forth. And then Pa comes back without the goose and Laura says, "Well, I wish you to I'd let you have it the way you want it." But it's a very cute little sister argument. And all about stuffing.
Well, let's have onion and sage.
Yes. Yeah, I like sage in mine, but yeah. So, so the green bean casserole. Now, I know this is what you went through the most rigmarole to get the information about.
I was astounded how protective these companies are of this recipe. They wouldn't allow the woman who developed this recipe in a test kitchen back in, I forget when, the 50s, late 40s or the 50s, wouldn't let her talk to Kathleen without a company spokesperson right there on the edge. Couldn't talk about how she developed the recipe. They're very protective of it, considering that this is now a standard Thanksgiving, in fact, Christmas fare. And for all I know, maybe it crops up in Easter, too. I really don't know. I do know that you can practically tell what time of year it is by the cans of green beans and Durkee's onion rings and the soup that appears on the end of the aisles in the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And I know a lot of people think it's not, you know, you can't have the holiday without this particular little casserole. But for something that was developed in a test kitchen specifically for the Thanksgiving market, it's amazing to me how that has completely, totally caught on. I mean, there was just it has been. I bet most people aren't aware that it was a development that it came out of a test kitchen. It's just so much a part of family traditions now that I don't think that its origins are kind of lost, but it comes to us directly from industry, and it accounts for the highest consumption of French's fried onions for the whole year. In other words, the company makes those fried onion and puts them in the little cans, and an enormous proportion of the total consumption of that product occurs at Thanksgiving and Christmas. Astounding.
It is good, though, even though it is just out of the test kitchen. The best one I ever had, though, was this restaurant, and they'd made it, and they used like real slices of mushroom in there, and
oh, yeah.
They had genuine, real deep-fried onion rings on top. It was just so good.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that would be fabulous. Yeah.
Now, I wanted to run by something else from the Laura books, because I don't know if you had ever heard about this, but there is a scene in On the Banks of Plum Creek where Laura talks about having 3 kernels of parched corn by each of the plates, and they're supposed to eat that and think about the pilgrims that didn't have much to eat. I have found it listed other places as either the 3 kernels or the 5 kernels, and sometimes people have come up with little supposed meanings for each one of the kernels that you're supposed to eat them. Did you find anything about a tradition like that in doing your research?
No. No. That's fascinating. I know I read all those books, but I don't remember that. Isn't that interesting? What a good idea. That's anything at all that puts us in touch with where our food comes from, I think is a good thing for all of us to ponder. Lovely, lovely.
Well, I really kind of wonder where Laura got it, though, because I don't think, I just haven't found much of a tradition about it. So that's something that I'm still trying to track down where it came from, because I don't think she made it up, though, you know, who knows.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, where there's smoke, there's bound to be fire, so wouldn't it be fun to see where the fire is?
Yes. Now, we're actually... We got about 10 minutes left, so I'm going to skip some of the questions that I had there because there were a couple things that I really wanted to get to, and one of which was that today there are a lot of foods, a lot of dishes that only get made in honor of a special day like Thanksgiving or Christmas or Hanukkah or any of that kind of thing. But from experience, these are the kind of dishes that usually if you only make them or anything even remotely like them once a year, your cooking or basic baking skill level may not be up to the task. Do you see Thanksgiving meals changing as the general level of culinary skills in the country continues to erode from lack of use? And it doesn't seem like a lot of times that families get together enough to pass on those cooking traditions. Have you seen any signs of that, or do you think that's coming?
Oh, I think in some places that may be true. There's altogether too much opportunity to take the family out to eat on Thanksgiving, in my opinion. I think it ends up being kind of an imposition on folks who might otherwise like to be home eating turkey with their own families, and they're working in a restaurant instead. So I think a lot of people have decided that Thanksgiving is too much bother, and so they like to go out to eat. And I suppose this erosion of confidence, if not actual skills, accounts for the turkey hotline that's set up. It's an 800 number, I think, that you can call and ask any question you might have pertaining to cooking your turkey. It's possible for so many families are eating small things that they can heat up quickly and easily. I suppose that tackling a whole large something like a turkey is a bit daunting for some folks. And so, yeah, it's a little too easy to buy a pie at a church pie sale on the day or two before Thanksgiving. It's a little too easy, perhaps, to get those cans of stuff and dump them into a casserole and call it good. On the other hand, you know, a couple of years ago, there was a very interesting cover on the New Yorker magazine that showed a whole lot of guys in the kitchen, and they were stirring and sniffing and sampling, and they have aprons on, and they're clustered around the stove, and then you look through a door, and the women are watching TV and cheering a football team on, and I thought, well, that's an interesting comment. You know, as cooking becomes sort of a recreational activity, there's a whole bunch of people who are delving into more recherche Thanksgiving efforts, I suppose, and people who are sort of responsible daily for meals are saying, sure, let's let them do it. Help yourself, fella.
So if people want to learn more, I highly recommend that they get your book, Giving Thanks. Do you want to tell them how to do that?
The best way to do it is to look online. At this point, the book is out of print. It was published in 2005, but you can get used copies readily online, and you can also get copies from Plymouth Plantation, and you can go to their website, or you can call them up and order the book that way.
But that's not your only book, and they're all good stuff. So do you want to give us some of your other titles?
Well, I'll start with my newest book, which is called Maine Home Cooking, 175 Recipes from Down East Maine, published by Down East just this past fall. Down East Publishing, the same people who do the magazine. And I've been out and about with that book. It's real fun read, I think, and it has a lot of really just terrific, ordinary, everyday recipes in it, along with the stories that come from the people who sent me the recipes for my column in the Bangor Daily News, Taste Buds, along with their memories and their advice on the various dishes. It's almost a community cookbook, excepting it isn't. I have put it all together. I'm also the author of Saltwater Foodways, New Englanders and Their Food at Sea and Ashore in the 19th Century, which is a regional food history, New England, of New England coastal foodways. I'm the author of Food in Federal and Colonial America. Oops, I always get that twisted around. Author Food in Colonial and Federal America, published by Greenwood Press. Those were my major efforts.
Well, they are well worth having to anybody who's interested in food. So I hope that you have a huge spike in sales after this.
Oh, me too. Thank you very much.
And we actually have just a little bit more time than I thought we did, so I'm going to ask you one more Thanksgiving question before I kind of let you go. As you look around at Thanksgiving today, did you find a lot of other cultural groups were adapting Thanksgiving to their own cultural standards, or do people tend to stick with the traditional foods as we think of them, even if they're not their own?
Thanksgiving, everybody understands about feasts. Everybody understands about thanks. So it's really easy to buy into a holiday like this that features a feast and an opportunity to be grateful. So, and everybody has festival foods. And what happens is a lot of people say, okay, it's a festival, so I'm gonna cook festival foods. And if you are Vietnamese or if you are Somali or whatever your ethnic heritage might be, you're going to cook your own festival foods. But in order to be show that you're an American, you're very likely to have a turkey as well. So an awful lot of cultures don't do this one large presentation bird on the table. They're very likely to whack it up in small pieces and cook it, but they will have turkey. Or in some cases, families will say, well, we observe that in America that's, for example, lasagna is a very important dish. A lot of Americans really like lasagna. There's lasagna suppers. And so we want to be American, so we're going to have turkey and we're going to have lasagna too. And they sort of pull the lasagna in and add it onto the meal. It's a fascinating thing to see how Thanksgiving becomes a way of expressing who you were and who you hope to become.
Well, thank you. I'm glad we got that one in because I did think that was an interesting question that you looked at. But we got about 2 minutes left, so I'm going to go ahead and thank you for coming on, Sandy. Unless there's something else that you wanted that we didn't get to that you wanted to sneak in there.
No, nothing I can think of, excepting I hope you have a great Thanksgiving. What are you going to do?
Okay. Well, we're going to have everybody come to our house. And we're going to have turkey and turducken and sweet potatoes with marshmallows. And we didn't get our hickory nuts for hickory nut rolls this year, so we're going to have to buy English walnuts, which is sad. But we'll have the nut rolls and all that good stuff. And cornbread, because my cousin Chelsea always says it isn't Thanksgiving if there isn't any cornbread. So we have to have cornbread.
Wonderful. Sounds wonderful.
And, yeah, and I'm going to be doing the stuffing this year, I think, the dressing, because that was always my grandmother's contribution, and so I haven't done it. So we'll see how it turns out.
Oh, good luck.
So how about you? You got something planned?
Yes, ma'am. Matter of fact, my friend Kathy Kerr was over this afternoon, and we talked about the menu. We're going to have turkey and mashed potatoes, and then we're going to do something special with Brussels sprouts that are still in the garden. And I think probably my molded cranberry salad. I'll do something with an apple pie. She's going to do something in the vicinity of a pumpkin pie. We'll see what happens.
Well, good luck to you too.
And I'm
glad that the superstorm didn't get up as far as you and that everything's okay. And I hope I will be hearing from you again real soon.
Thank you, Sarah. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. And happy Thanksgiving to everybody else. And I just want to remind you one last time that next Wednesday, we're going to be talking about Ellen Montgomery and the Ballet Museum. And I think that'll be another great show. I hope that you enjoy it. And we're just a hair over. So have a happy Thanksgiving and enjoy the rest of your week. Thank you.